cutting through an overload of information to get to the heart of the story. This is The Point.
Are the United States and China always on the course of collision? Renowned American scholar Graham Allison's past inquiry gains renewed significance as we examine the shifts in relations between the two major countries over the past year and their impact on the world. The onset of 2023 witnessed the U.S. shooting down a so-called Chinese spy balloon, triggering a diplomatic row. Subsequently, as two sides engaged in discussions, the once frozen ties gradually began to thaw. The culmination of the year featured a face-to-face meeting between presidents of the two sides in San Francisco. So, are we heading towards war or peace? How will the evolving relationship impact the global landscape in 2024? I'm pleased to be joined from Cambridge, Massachusetts by Professor Graham Allison, Douglas Dillon Professor of Government of Harvard's John F. Kennedy School. Professor Allison, thank you very much for joining us. The ancient Athenian historian military general Thucydides suggested that the outbreak of the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta was inevitable because the Spartans' fear of the growth of the Athenian power. Now, you coined the concept of the Thucydides trap 10 years ago to describe the tendency towards war when a rising power challenges the status of a ruling power. And in your 2017 book, Destined for War, with a question mark, you argue that though a war between China and the U.S. is not inevitable, it may be very difficult to avoid and requires extensive and intensive diplomatic attention and exertion. As we stand on the threshold of 2024, has your view evolved?
Thank you very much. That's a very good summary of the argument. And I think if Thucydides were watching 2023 or watching the past decade, he would say the two superpowers are right on track, almost as if right on script, almost as if each were trying to show which could better exemplify the classic role of the rising power or alternatively the ruling power. So he's sitting on the edge of his seat, anticipating the grandest collision of all times.
All right, let's break down the year 2023 in greater detail. I'm going to have a very quick timeline of what happened in 2023 from our perspective. As I said, in February, Washington accused China of using a weather balloon to spy on the U.S., but the Pentagon would say in June that the balloon did not collect information at all. But that incident drove bilateral ties to a new low. In March, after years of open hostility, Saudi Arabia and Iran agreed to restore diplomatic ties, and the talks were seen as facilitated by China. In March, China and Honduras established diplomatic ties, reducing the number of countries that diplomatically recognized Taiwan to 13. In June, Russian mercenary chief Yevgeny Prigozhin staged a rebellion in Russia, and days later, Prigozhin called off the advance of his troops to Moscow. In August, six countries, including Argentina, Egypt, Ethiopia, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE, were invited to become new BRICS members during the latest BRICS summit in Johannesburg, South Africa. Also in August, Japan started releasing nuclear-contaminated wastewater from the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant into the Pacific Ocean, despite raging opposition at home and abroad. In October, the Israel-Hamas conflict broke out in Gaza as Hamas militants launched an unprecedented attack on Israel, killing 1,200 people and abducting 240 people as hostages. And health officials in Gaza have so far reported 20,000 deaths, including 8,000 children. In October, the third Belt and Road Forum for International Cooperation was convened in Beijing, bringing together representatives from 140 countries and 30-plus international organizations. And in November, Chinese President Xi Jinping and U.S. President Joe Biden met in San Francisco, and the two sides agreed on a future-oriented San Francisco vision. So there you have it, our look at the world at a glimpse. So what term, Professor Allison, would you use to characterize the geopolitical landscape of 2023?
That's an excellent summary you gave us, and it reminds us what a roller coaster we've been on. I could comment on each one of the points, but I think if I can jump to the San Francisco meeting and the summit, I think that returned to the conversation that had been held the previous November in Bali between President Xi and President Biden. And I would take those two points as the points of light or hope in the situation as we think about the relationship between the U.S. and China. And the main point about them was not the specific agreements that came out of them, the so-called deliverables, so those were important. What was most important was that two adult presidents, each of whom understands that a war between the U.S. and China would be catastrophic for his own country, sat down and talked privately, candidly, explicitly, and that actually what they actually talked about, you and I don't even know, which can be frustrating to some people in the press, but to me is very reassuring that adults can sit down and privately and quietly and candidly have explicit conversations. I think they talked about each his own red lines and his country's red lines. Mm-hmm. They talked about ways in which misunderstandings, miscalculations, accidents, provocations by other parties could drag them into something that they don't want. And I think the fact that the two of them took out now more time at the San Francisco meeting gives me a sense that at least there are two adults in charge here. And despite the fact that there are many, many incidents and accidents from balloons to God knows what else, and there'll be more and more such disturbances and confusion, having two leaders at the helm who are adults and who have their feet on the ground and are able to talk to each other. One of the, I think, very important things that came out of San Francisco is President Xi said, if something comes up, give me a phone call. Mm-hmm. Well, that's exactly what you want from adult leaders.
You repeated just now that Thucydides wouldn't be surprised by any of the behaviors involved in the U.S.-China relationship. But just now you just said, you know, you have adults in the room. And now that we have people like you who are pointing out the great danger if two great powers don't talk to each other, don't learn from the past, do you think Thucydides would be surprised, especially seeing what happened in San Francisco?
That's a good question, an excellent question. And it's a good point. I think he would be surprised, but he would be gratified. So Thucydides was not a fatalist. When he wrote the book about war was inevitable, he meant almost inevitable, or inevitable if all that the leaders could manage is diplomacy as usual, or statecraft as usual. But as he says in the introduction to his book, why am I writing this book? I'm writing this book because I'm trying to point out the mistakes that were made that led to this conclusion in the hope that people in the future will learn from these lessons and adapt them and do better. So he was not being fatalistic about this at all. Mm. He was being hopeful that intelligent successors would read, think about, and manage the situation better. So what I said in the Destined for War book is if all that leaders can manage is business as usual, or diplomacy as usual, or statecraft as usual, then we should expect history as usual.
Okay.
And history as usual would be a war. But we don't have to settle for that. And I think that's the sign in the San Francisco spirit that was exhibited both by Xi and Biden.
Professor Allison, let me ask you this question, which I've been curious all along. Is there a question mark at the end of your book title? Because people don't seem to notice that.
Absolutely. If you look at carefully at the book, you'll see that the last two chapters, the first is called 12, the next to the last chapter is called 12 Clues for Peace. So what I try to do is look at the 16 cases that are studied in the book over the last 500 years, 12 failures and 4 successes, and say, well, what can we extract from this? What can we learn from it that we might adapt and apply in the current situation? And the final chapter is called Where Do We Go From Here, which points to the search for a strategy. I think that's something that we're still on. I don't think either the American government or the Chinese government have yet a appropriate conceptualization of this.
Yeah.
I mean, Henry Kissinger, up to the last days of his life, was calling for a strategic concept that would capture the fact that while the U.S. and China are for sure going to be fierce rivals, that's baked in for the Thucydidean dynamic, at the same time, their survival requires that they be thick partners.
Yeah.
So well, how to do two things at the same time. Yep.
Yeah, this is extremely interesting that you brought up Dr. Kissinger, because I was going to bring him up too. By the way, in his meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping in his last trip to China, Dr. Kissinger, and may he rest in peace, he said, under the current circumstances, it is important to abide by the principles set out in the Shanghai communique, understand the extreme importance of the One China principle to China, and steer the development of U.S.-China relations in a positive direction. So for those of us who don't understand, and the communique was signed by both sides by former U.S. President Nixon ended his icebreaking trip in China in 1972. And in the document, the U.S. acknowledged that all Chinese on either side of the Taiwan Straits maintain that there is only one, that there is but one China, and that Taiwan is a part of China. So do you agree with Dr. Kissinger's assessment that it is important for the U.S. to understand the extreme importance of the One China principle to China, and given the elections that we're going to see in January in Taiwan?
Yes, absolutely, yes. So I talked to Henry both before he went to China in the summer and after, and then he and I actually wrote an article in Foreign Affairs just in October, which was his last published piece, that we were working on before he went to China and after, which was focused on the question of how AI is impacting both China and the US. And I think what Henry recognized and what the Shanghai communique captures is the germ of what I hope will be a viable, constructive relationship between the US and China. And the essence of it is that you can have irreconcilable differences between countries, irreconcilable for the moment, but that doesn't mean that it's unmanageable. So what they did in the Shanghai communique, under the One China policy and recognition, was recognize that from the Chinese perspective and from views on both sides of the straits, there's one China, its capital is Beijing, and Taiwan is part of China. That's point one. Point two, but that the U.S. and some people in Taiwan were committed to the proposition that this will evolve over time and that China would not use military force to reintegrate Taiwan into the mainland. So that seems a little bit of conflict with the first principle. And how can you wrap those two things together and nonetheless manage the relationship? The answer is, look at the last 50 years. In the last 50 years, citizens on both sides of the strait have seen greater improvement in their lives, their health, their wealth, their longevity, than in any 5 decades in their whole career. So it's perfectly possible to have differences that you can't resolve right now, but you can still be smart enough to manage. Mm. That's what was done in the Shanghai communique. I think that's actually a good clue for the larger relationship between the U.S. and China. But for sure, at San Francisco, President Xi and Biden talked about this clearly. Mm-hmm. President Biden always been very clear that the U.S. subscribes entirely to the One China policy as it's reflected in the Shanghai communique.
Mm-hmm. Well, China used the term One China principle, but nonetheless, if you go and read the original wording of the communique, it is very clear. And it is the U.S. position that the conflict shall be resolved in a peaceful manner, which is also stated very clear. China has different opinion, but I think for the sake of the greater good of both countries and for the world, the both sides, as you said, Professor Allison, that they decided to shelve their differences and move on with their bilateral relationship. I think that is a very important spirit to highlight. Now, during a high-level meeting of the UN Security Council in November, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said that the world is at a crossroads between war and peace. In your opinion, is the world edging more towards war or towards peace? Where does that needle stand?
now with war in the Middle East that may actually spread to become a wider war, kind of have the feeling that, well, maybe things are getting out of control. You know, that just, I mean, I think many people today feel like, well, we're the world's coming unhinged. I think, unfortunately, as we move into a multipolar world, which is what we've done, it will be the case that more and more states will find it in their interest to use force to try to advance their interests. And I think that's going to make the world a more dangerous place for all of us, a more dangerous place for the U.S., and a more dangerous place for China, which from my perspective is yet another reason why the countries that have the strongest interest in maintaining a international order without hot wars find ways to cooperate in trying to limit these. So one of the topics for conversation at San Francisco was whether, in the case of the war between Russia and Ukraine, there's some role that the China and the U.S. could play together in trying to bring this killing to an end. I think that's very positive. In fact, I had earlier argued that I thought President Xi had almost unique opportunity to play a special role in this because of China's special relationship, both with Russia and with Ukraine, which China had a very strong relationship with right from the beginning of Ukraine, you know, when it became an independent country after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, obviously, Xi Jinping has a lot of things on his plate, a lot of things to do. Last year was a very busy year, but I still think it's an opportunity for China. And the Middle East, slightly more complicated, but nonetheless, you made the point, you know, who played the main role in brokering normalization relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia? It was not the U.S., was not the locals, it was China.
Let's see, China does have a long way to go in terms of diplomatic reach and diplomatic persuasion, let's say. Thank you very much, Professor Graham Allison, for sharing with us your valuable insights. Thank you very much.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you much. Look forward to seeing you in person.
Thank you. Same here. My exclusive interview with Graham Allison, Douglas Dillon Professor of Government of Harvard's John F. Kennedy School. When we come back, where is the shift in China-U.S. relations leading us? I talked to Li Cheng, Professor of Political Science at the University of Hong Kong. He had just concluded a 17-year stint at the Washington-based Brookings Institution to head a new research center in Hong Kong. What's his take on the year 2023? And 2024.
Making room for all opinions and seeing events from more than one side. This is The Point.
It's been a challenging year for all of us. Sluggish global growth, renewed bloodshed, and humanitarian crises, just to name a few. What will 2023 be remembered in history by? My second guest is Professor Li Cheng, whose experience straddles the two countries. In 2023, he left the Brookings Institution, a world-leading think tank based in Washington, where he spent 17 years as a China expert, to return to Hong Kong to build a think tank at the University of Hong Kong from scratch. I'm pleased to be joined by Li Cheng, Professor of Political Science and Founding Director of the Center on Contemporary China and the World from Southern China's Shenzhen City. Professor Li, welcome to The Point.
So, thank you for having me.
What word would you use to describe the global geopolitical landscape in 2023?
I think it's a worry. And for many countries, they worry about their economy partly because the structure change in their own country, and partly because of the global slowdown of the economy. But this may be the lowest level compared with some countries just had election or are going to have election, worry about their future. And in the case of the United States, I think people worry about the 2024 election. It's restate obvious, we enter a period of uncertainty. And for American democracy, this will be a test, a big test for United States. And many elites worry about the election, and also the partisan politics become so vicious some issues become very intensified, whether it be women's rights, gay rights, and gun control, and immigration policy, and these are very, very divisive. But the really the moment is the 2024 election. Mm-hmm. But this is the second level. But also many countries, they're caught up in a war. In the case of Myanmar, it's a civil war. It's a very, kill a lot of people. But the war also continue in Ukraine and also now spill over to Middle East. So of course that also that it would be naive to think that the war only will remain in European continent or in the Middle East. I think people worry about the expand to some other regions. So I will use the word worry. To describe the 2023.
Well, the relationship between China and the United States is one of the most important. I think people can agree on that. And I talked to Professor Graham Allison of Harvard University. He thinks that the Thucydides trap theory is still relevant, although we are seeing adults in the room or shadows of adults in the room. He was talking about the San Francisco summit between presidents of China and the United States. But overall, he thinks the U.S. and China is still on a collision course if both sides go about business as usual. Would you agree?
No, I disagree. I think the Thucydides trap that it's really locked in a fatalistic view sounds like emerging power and existing power can only end up with a war or conflict. Of course, that Graham Allison will not go that far. He's like, there's a chance for that. But the fact that the title is a designated war, the question mark is very small. I think this is, could be quite
Oh, good that you noticed there is a question mark there, but you notice it's a small
That's
one.
Right. That's right. But I don't think it's fatalistic. And also use the war between Sparta and Athens 2,000 years ago to describe it. Today's world, it's completely wrong because there was no economic realization. There's a nuclear, no nuclear weapon. And most importantly, there's no AI, which completely changed the global economic, political, technological landscape. I think this will be a terrible thing that if existing power and emerging power caught up in a designated war. I think the war can and should and must be avoided. But one thing is that Thucydides was insightful when he wrote, 2,000 years ago. I was a graduate student when looking at his original work. He said that driving countries' relationship are two factors. One is greed, and the second is honor, the third is fear. So he argued among these three things, fear is the most important factor to explain the state-to-state relations. So I think that it's fair to say that U.S.-China relations also enter a period by mutually reinforced fear and animosity that caused us in trouble. But the point is that, that the war should be avoided. I think the San Francisco summit by President Biden and President Xi Jinping is a good example that despite all the differences, we the state leaders, the statesman-like leaders, also concerned about how to avoid that trap and particularly emphasize issues on security, whether to establish a male-to-male relationship or from the U.S. side to restate the One China policy where China expressed concern over Taiwan Strait and et cetera, particularly the upcoming Taiwan election.
Do you think that conversation or the understanding that they must sit down or keep the communications channel, do you think that's sustainable going into 2024? And if so, what that means for the world?
Well, it may or may not be stable, but the important thing is we much better to have that meeting. Now, that meeting is not supposed to change it, profoundly change U.S.-China relations or completely stop the deterioration, but it's trying to find a floor to stabilize the relationship. Now, we do need to be realistic that if you look at the past few years, there's always the policy, the summit actually hijacked by some interest group. Remember that in the 2018, the Argentina meeting, G20, U.S. leader Donald Trump met with Xi Jinping. The evening dinner went very well, but that evening that the U.S. John Bolton ordered the arrest of Meng Wanzhou, and CFO of Huawei, that day in Canada. So that just jeopardize U.S.-China relation, make all this agreement become so irrelevant. So from time to time, we do see this hijack things, including the blue incident early this year. So we cannot eliminate that possibility. But most importantly, the state leaders, despite all the differences, they come together. They talk about common interests. They talk about particularly avoid the incidents. And using the President Biden's word, guardrail, and it's very, very important, whether it be East China Sea or South China Sea. I think that there are a lot of military exercise going on. I think it's very, very important to establish male-to-male relations. But also China reaffirm China's strong position about certainly be very critical about the so-called the Asia version of NATO. This is certainly undermine China's interest. I think Chinese leaders express very, very strongly about that. Mm-hmm. But on the top of that, I think that one of the achievements, as both leaders mentioned, although it's not fully announced yet, is the agreement or consensus by both countries about the human control of use nuclear weapon in the era of AI. This is a great achievement because it's very, very important that because we cannot expect this kind of AI war could be limited war or plastic war when the start, you cannot stop. So from day one, we should reaffirm the human control. This will be landmark agreement and can be also used to deal with some other major issues in the, chemical war, biological war, and et cetera.
Yeah.
So I think as the two superpower in AI field reach that agreement, it's very, very important.
Dr. Li Cheng, Professor of Political Science and Founding Director of the Center on Contemporary China and the World of the University of Hong Kong.
Thank you.
And with that, we come to the end of this special edition of The Point with me, Liu Xin. You can follow me on Facebook and Twitter using the handle Liu Xin in Beijing.